I thought we had gone upscale there, David. We were going to have music intros. Good morning. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge. I am your host for today, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. The Doctor's Lounge is supported by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We support free market solutions to the problems facing healthcare today. We support a doctor-patient relationship unencumbered by regulations, third-party payers, politicians, bureaucrats, and other folks that I call competitive stakeholders in the business and in delivery of healthcare. So as we come to the show this morning, and I bet Hal talked about this last week, we are kind of fresh off a meeting out in Keystone called the Summit at the Summit, which was a great meeting that we'll talk about in future shows, has left us all kind of reinvigorated to support the cause, the noble cause that we're after here. So to that end, this morning we have a very special guest. We have Sally Pipes, who is the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. She is also the Thomas W. Smith Fellow for Healthcare Policy for that same group, and she writes regularly for Forbes and Wall Street Journal, appears in media all the time, and definitely one of the smartest people I know and definitely the smartest person in the room this morning. So good morning, Sally, and thank you for coming.
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me on.
So today we're tasked with a recent anniversary, if you will, right? We have Medicare and Medicaid and associated programs having just passed their 50th anniversary from July 30th, 1965. If you go to CMS.gov or Medicare.gov, you see all sorts of glowing articles about how wonderful that is and blog posts about how wonderful it is that Medicare has been keeping Americans healthy for 50 years. What do you think?
Well, I have to disagree with that. If you look at the evidence, which I did in two articles, one in the Wall Street Journal called Medicare at 50, Hello Midlife Crisis, and the other in the New York Post called The Medicaid Poverty Trap is Growing Worse. When you look at the numbers, both of these programs are financially unsound at the moment. The president, as you said, Mike, the 50th anniversary of these two programs was on Thursday, July 30th, and the president, in his radio address on Saturday, said all of those people out there who are being critical of Medicare and Medicaid, just are wrong. And that is just—he is actually telling a lie. When you look at when you look at the numbers, Lyndon Johnson was president in 1965. He signed a bill which included Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare is the program for seniors in this country, for people who turn 65. And then Medicaid is the program for low-income Americans, and it also, it was actually an add-on at the last minute to the Medicare bill. So Lyndon Johnson, as most people know, was a very liberal Democratic president. He wanted to get the government more and more involved in the lives of Americans. He was the father of what we say the Great Society. He brought a lot of government programs to America, and as I say, Medicare and Medicaid are now both 50 years old. They have a lot of people on them. They're costing a lot of money, and the Medicare trustees and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services say that if these programs are not changed and spending is not brought under control and fraud is not eliminated, these programs will be bankrupt around 2030. Each of them right now costs about close to $500 billion a year. By 2030, these programs, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, are estimated to cost about close to $1 trillion in 2030, and they're not sustainable.
So what do you, what do we do about that? I mean, this is a, although, Medicare and Medicaid technically, were born 50 years ago, their gestation period goes back probably about 120 years, all the way back to Europe and Germany and Otto von Bismarck and the need to, or society's demand that we come up with a macro method of taking care of folks who get sick. Now here we are either 50 years later or 120 years later, depending on how you look at it. And, we have to change things. The question is how, I suppose.
Right, exactly. Well, President Woodrow Wilson, President FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they were both very keen on getting the government involved in healthcare, a sort of a way to you know, help the elderly and help low-income get health coverage. And unfortunately, the Medicaid program, the program for low-income, it was President Johnson saw it as a way out of poverty, but it's now a way to keep, to trap people in poverty. And, you know, under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, one of the main components of the law is the expansion of Medicaid. The president thought that all states would want to expand their Medicaid programs because up to 75% of the funding for Medicaid for the states would come from the federal government for a few years. He is now following the second major loss for the repeal and replacement of Obamacare under the King v. Burwell U.S. Supreme Court decision from back in June. The president is now, because the law, you know, so far is able to stay in place because the court ruled that the subsidies provided to people, low-income people in America, people between Medicaid, 133% of the federal poverty level and 400% of the federal poverty level, if they were enrolled in healthcare.gov, the federal exchange, they would be able to keep their subsidies. So the president has now got a new wind in his sails going around those 20 states that under the Affordable Care Act did not expand their Medicaid programs, and he's trying to encourage them to do so. So he's in, you know, states which have a lot, Republican governors, whether it's Tennessee, Alaska, Utah. And I think that what he really wants to do is to get all of the states in the country to expand their Medicaid programs, which, as you know, Mike, a lot of states are in financial difficulty. Their budgets are not sustainable as they are. And if they do agree to expand their Medicaid programs, there's going to be additional fiscal pressure. Excuse me. And I think, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is, does this mean that the president will say, well, you know, we now have 49 or 50 states with expanded Medicaid programs, they can't afford them, therefore, I think we really need to bring the Medicaid program entirely under the federal government, and so it wouldn't be a sharing program between the states and the federal government. And then, you know, he may well say, well, now we've got Medicaid is under the federal government. We have Medicare. And then the third sort of
part of the three-legged stool.
The leg of the stool is really the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So this might then be an opportunity to say, well, why don't we bring Medicaid and CHIP under Medicare? And then we'll have a huge government program such as almost, you know, like the Canadian program. The only people that won't be part of a government program will be those of us who are above 400% of the federal poverty level, or who are, you know, under age 65 or 70, depending on when you take Medicare. And this opens up a whole new can of worms for those people in America, the president included, who would like to see a Medicare for all single payer healthcare system. We've certainly seen in the campaign with Bernie Sanders, you know, out there saying he's challenging Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. He is a huge fan of a single-payer Medicare for all system. So that phrase is now back in the limelight, and there's a lot of discussion. And I think this would just be, you know, the worst possible situation for this country. We have to repeal and replace Obamacare with a replacement plan that puts, as you know, like doctors and patients in charge of their health care and not the federal government.
Well, exactly, and I, you know, there's a book that you may be familiar with by David Goldhill that's called Catastrophic Care: Why Everything You Think You Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. And since I've read the book, I end up quoting it just about every time I get in front of an audience or a microphone, because there's so much good stuff in there. But I think part of the reason we've had this explosive growth is because once you create a program where, you know, you buy in, and then once you buy in, there's no incentive to hold the benefits in check. And now we have a situation, you know, ever since the Stabilization Act of 1942, where, you know, health insurance is no longer insurance as strictly defined. It's a benefit program. And so there's nothing to stop, you know, the folks getting insured from pressuring to expand benefits farther and farther and farther. And, you know, one of the things that comes out of that, I think you've written up nicely in the recent New York Post article, because there's, I guess there's some rather perverse arithmetic or some perverse incentives if somebody is, you know, I think you said, what, 133% of poverty level, they get a defined level of benefits. But if they go up another dollar in income, things change, don't they?
Right. Well, exactly. So if you are at 133% of federal poverty level, which is an income of around $15,000 for an individual, you then you're eligible for the Medicaid program. But if you earn more than that, then you lose that benefit. And so if you're employed, the issue is, well, does your employer offer health coverage? You know, under the Affordable Care Act, a person to be eligible has to work only 30 hours a week instead of the 40, which is part of the federal labor law. And so, you know, if you then, if your employer has 100 or more employees this year, and you're eligible, but you decide, but if you're earning less than 9.5% if you're paying less than 9.5% of your income for health care, you know, you may turn the coverage down, and then you're not even eligible for subsidized coverage in the exchange, and nor can you qualify for Medicaid. So there are a lot of perverse incentives, which this really encourages people to work fewer hours and to stay below the poverty line and keep Medicare coverage. And the CMS did a study about a year ago showing that they could really see that that Medicaid and the subsidies from 138 to 400% of federal poverty level are a way to keep people either not working or working very few hours, under 30 hours a week. So, and then you're seeing employers saying, well, you know, we want to reduce a lot of our, you know, employees, particularly part-time in the service sector, whether fast food, in those kinds of industries, Walmart, to below 30 hours a week so they don't have to provide health care coverage, because it is expensive. So,
and aren't we seeing, and I didn't have a chance to research this ahead of time, this is off the top of my head, but out in some Western states, I forget which they are, that since they've had a state-mandated increase in the minimum wage, that workers are volunteering to work less or are insisting on working less for that very reason, because the increase in the minimum wage, even with no change in hours, is taking them into a situation where they're actually losing money because of the incentives.
Right, exactly. So states like Washington State, in California, in various cities, San Francisco, Los Angeles, you know, the federal minimum wage, I think, is about $10 an hour. These states and particular cities on the West Coast are, you know, increasing that minimum wage over a few years from up to $15 or $20 an hour. And as the great Walter Williams, economics professor, said, raising the minimum wage, you know, is one of the best ways for employers not to expand the number of employees that they have, because, you know, you pay people based on their productivity, and if young people in particular and people without skills, you come into the labor force at a lower rate, and as you start becoming more productive, you earn more money and you go above the minimum wage. But the minimum wage is a great way to keep young people and minorities out of the labor force, because people won't hire them, because it's not a productive endeavor if you're a company that wants to stay in business.
They always seem to forget that the system is dynamic, and when you do things, behavior is going to change. Sally, we are at the hard break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio, sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. I am your host for this morning, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. With me is very special guest Sally Pipes, President and CEO of the Pacific Research Foundation and Thomas Smith Fellow in Healthcare Policy. We are talking about the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid this week. And, again, with a historical perspective, Sally, you know, when this was passed in 65, I guess there was kind of a confluence of historical forces, right? I mean, going back to 1912 and the Progressive Party, they called for national health insurance. When Social Security was signed by FDR, there was a push to include a Medicare-type coverage for older citizens, which was passed on at the last minute, actually at the advice of a famous physician, Dr. Harvey Cushing, which if you're a doc, you know who that is. And the pressure just continued to build even through the Eisenhower administrations, even though he really wasn't very interested, until finally we get to 1965, the re-election election of Lyndon Johnson, and in a very, very Democratic-heavy Congress, and then this thing is passed into law in 1965.
Well, exactly. And these programs, as I say, the Medicare program designed for senior citizens and the Medicaid program designed for low-income people, you know, were not expected to cost that much money to the American taxpayer. And you remember, when Medicare came into being in 1965, at the end of the first year, 1966, Medicare cost about $3 billion. Today, in 1967, the House Ways and Means Committee predicted that the program would cost $12 billion by 1990. And, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, statistics are a lot like sausages. You like them a lot better if you don't know what went into them.
Yeah.
But when they did the final numbers on what Medicare cost the American people in 1990, it cost $110 billion. So instead of $12 billion, it cost 10 times as much, which is very worrying when you look at Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. The president had wanted a health care law that cost about $900 billion over 10 years. We're already in the sort of decade 2015 to 2024. We're looking at around $1.2 trillion. The original costing by the Congressional Budget Office was $940 billion over 10 years. Now we're at $1.3, $1.4 trillion over the decade. And my feeling, and a number of other economists agree, that this program, you know, 2016 to 2025, around there, is probably 2020 to 2019, we're probably looking at a cost of this program at about $2.6 trillion. So that is, you know, a lot more money than $900 billion over 10 years. And when you look at these Medicare numbers, the estimates and the cost, it doesn't give you much confidence in the work done by government officials to figure out what they cost. And of course, in 1965, the Congressional Budget Office, you know, was not in existence. But even so, we rarely see a government program, Mike, that comes in at the cost of what people estimate it will cost. And last year in 2014, Medicare cost $511 billion. And the Kaiser Family Foundation has predicted that in 7 years, this program is going to cost, you know, $1 trillion. So those combined with the projection from the Medicare trustees that we just heard in last month, in July, the main trust, hospital trust fund will be bankrupt by 2030. So we need to make changes to these programs where cost is out of control. Medicaid is costing almost $500 billion a year. It's covering 71 million Americans now. It has expanded so much under the Affordable Care Act, under Obamacare. So it also will not be sustainable. So we need to make changes to these programs so that Medicare is there to help those truly low-income seniors that are you know, can't afford coverage. And then Medicaid, we need to, you know, block grant that program and get the states to do, like, health savings accounts, but instead health opportunity accounts, so that we can bring these programs, the spending of them under control, so, as I say, they can remain in business for the people that truly need them. I mean, if you look at Medicare, Mike, I mean, in 1965, the average American, when the program came into being, lived till age 65. Today, the average American lives, you know, to 80. And so for 15 years, you know, the government is providing them with health care. And a lot of these people, you know, today are working beyond age 65. They have, you know, significant savings, or they're still earning money. So they shouldn't really be in Medicare. They should be able to have private health insurance or continue. Health savings accounts are a great way for people to save money and to pay, you know, out of pocket for things that aren't covered by their health coverage. You set up a health savings account with your bank or your credit union, and then the trust company, and then you combine that with a high deductible insurance plan, so you have coverage for catastrophic health care, but you also have a way that you can pay out of pocket. So between setting up health savings accounts for people, for seniors, for providing premium support or a defined contribution plan for people to be covered, you know, with their health insurance when they're beyond 65, means testing so that you know, the people that, you know, aren't at a very low income, if we means test it, at least starting up with raising the eligibility age to 67 from the current 65, we're going to cut costs significantly and save about $19 billion by 2023. So these are some of the things that need to be done with Medicare if we don't want the program to go bankrupt, as the Medicare trustees and the Congressional Budget Office have predicted. And Medicaid, the same. I mean, all of this expansion under Obamacare, what does it mean for people who are low income? I mean, we know that a lot of the people who are now on Medicaid are having a hard time finding a doctor, because doctors don't want to take patients on Medicaid because the federal government reimbursement rate, you know, is so much lower than their cost. So what has been the outcome of not being able to get a doctor or having to wait too long for an appointment when you have something serious? We have seen exactly the opposite of what the president wanted for the American people. He wanted to reduce costly emergency room use. Well, under this expansion of Medicaid for low-income people, emergency room use is way up because these people can't, even though they have Medicaid coverage, having coverage does not mean you have access to health care. And so we're seeing, you know, increased emergency room use. And under Medicare, one in three new Medicare eligibles is having a hard time finding a doctor, because under Medicare, docs are only reimbursed 88% of what they get from treating someone with private coverage. So, if you turn 65 and you think, oh, I'm going to have terrific coverage under Medicare, well, if you're one of the people who can't find a doctor because of low reimbursement rates, you know, what does it mean for you? And I'm part of the baby boom generation, and now we're in the big, you know, the big bulge in the watermelon, the snake trying to get through the watermelon, a few young people at one end and a few older people at the other. But now, today, there are 10,000 new Americans are becoming eligible for Medicare because of the baby boom. So this puts tremendous pressure on this program. But if neither program is going to be providing health security, as the president had promised, these programs are out of control in terms of cost. There's a lot of fraud in these programs, because they just are there for fraud, for people who want to engage in fraudulent activity, and they're not helping the people they were designed to help. So when the president says these programs are working extremely well, they aren't, because costs are up, emergency room use is up, and people can't find doctors.
Well, right on all points, Sally. And I can tell you, you know, as a doc who's going to, you know, leave this radio show at 9 o'clock and have my first patient appointment in the office at 9:30 and, you know, see these folks in the trenches every day, that everything that you said is exactly correct. I mean, first on the HSA side, I mean, you can tell a change in patient behavior, one patient at a time, when folks have a first dollar cost and have a skin in the game, because they're the ones asking the right questions about what stuff is going to cost. And it's so frustrating, because you want to be able to give those numbers to patients, and we do as best we can, but so often, especially if it's going to involve, you know, care at a hospital or a facility that's outside of the practice, then it's impossible to get them the numbers that they want in terms of what it's going to cost them in advance. And it's a very, very, you know, frustrating thing for them, because they certainly have the right to know, and the HSA program definitely changes patient behavior in the right direction, even though, you know, I say that as somebody who would lose financially, because a lot of those folks, you know, they get sticker shock when they see what it's going to cost out of their HSA, and they say, you know what, you know, maybe I don't need that procedure. I'll be okay, because I'm not willing to put $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 more or more, you know, out of pocket into that procedure. You know, and the second thing you're absolutely right about is this whole intellectual sleight of hand, right, between the difference between sticking a healthcare card in somebody's hand and actually getting them access to care. And those are not the same thing. So they can talk about covered individuals, but it depends on how you define coverage. If you define coverage as sticking a card in their hand, fine. If you define coverage as actually getting them into a doctor's office, it's a very different situation.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. And, you know, certainly, you know, under Obama and the Affordable Care Act, he promised the American people two things. He promised that we would have universal coverage, that there would the uninsured number would be eliminated, and the cost of health care would go down. And remember, he promised the American people that the average family would see their premiums go down by $2,500 per year. Well, now we know, when looking at the statistics, that the average family is seeing their premiums go up by at least $800 a year. And one of the big issues is that a lot of people who signed on to the exchanges, whether a state exchange, such as in California with Covered California, or if you live in a state that did not build their own exchange and you're under the federal government's healthcare.gov, the access to doctors and hospital networks under the plans and the exchanges are much narrower than people ever thought. And a lot of people, you know, would buy a silver plan under Covered California or Cover Oregon or whatever, or under healthcare.gov, and think, well, I now have coverage. I can now go and see any doctor or any hospital or any specialist that I want, because I have coverage. And then they find out, when they call the doctor's office or they turn up at an emergency room, that doctor or that hospital is not covered. And so we're seeing increasing numbers of people that are finally finding out that just because they have their care card, they don't have coverage if they can't see the doctor or go to the hospital that they thought that they would be able to. Here in California, for example, a lot of people in the Los Angeles area, you know, really look up to the Cedars-Sinai Hospital and the docs there. But Cedars-Sinai did not take any insurance coverage under any of the plans in Covered California. And Anthem, one of the largest insurers in the country, is now, I mean, under the law, does not include. Anthem is the only program that actually covers the UCLA health system, which is extremely popular, extremely has very high ratings. And a lot of people think, well, I have health coverage now, I'll be able to see those top doctors at the UCLA Medical Center, and it just is not the case unless they have, you know, one of the high-end Anthem plans. So this has been a real shock to Americans, and as you know, Mike, you don't go to the doctor, you know, once a month or unless you have a severe chronic condition. And so, you know, most people aren't using their health care on a monthly basis, and maybe they go to the doctor once a year. So it takes time for people to realize, you know, what their coverage actually covers.
Sally, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. We're going to pick that sentence right up after the break. We're at the hard break. You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
My name is Dr. Jeff Terry from Mobile, Alabama. I love taking care of my patients and not computers. That is why I need your help. On October 1st, the government will mandate that I implement the new ICD-10 coding system, and if not able to do so, then I will be put out of business and my patients will have to find a new physician. Please call and write your congressmen and senators today and tell them no to ICD-10. Tell them physicians need a grace period in order to concentrate on you, the patient, and not the computer.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio, the show you come to hear what doctors are talking about amongst themselves, the issues that are important to us, kind of an inside track at what's important to your physician. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We support a doctor-patient relationship unencumbered by regulations, politicians, bureaucrats, and other competitive stakeholders in the healthcare process. Today we're talking about the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid with very special guest Sally Pipes, President and CEO of the Pacific Research Foundation. So Sally, I'm going to let you jump right back in. We were talking about healthcare exchange plans and the illusion that they put a card in your hand, and yet, as you were talking about out in California, it's not quite that simple.
Well, exactly. And people, the sign-ups in California, undercover California, and in a lot of states, have not been, what was predicted. The whole concept would be that the young invincibles, the young people between 18 and 31, would be buying coverage in these exchanges to be part of the risk pool, and they would be not using the healthcare system, and so that the people who are older, have chronic conditions, their premiums would go to help, sustain the people that are using a lot of healthcare. And of course, but as it's turned out, the statistics, the young invincibles are saying, I'd rather pay that penalty under the individual mandate of this year, it's $325 or 2.5% of income, so maybe pay $325 for the year rather than paying $325 per month coverage. The average premium for most of these plans is sort of $250 to $350, and we're looking at, as the states are talking about their premium rates increases for 2016, the range is 20 to 40%. Some states are coming in lower, California in particular at 4, but I think that's because insurance commissioner is putting pressure on insurance companies to keep rates low because we're coming into an election year next year and they don't want healthcare to seem to be too expensive. But a lot of people are making decisions, as I say, to not purchase coverage and pay the individual mandate penalty because they either can't afford to pay $250 to $350 a month for health coverage, or because they think they won't get sick. And so there's really a problem. How are the insurance companies going to stay business if they can't cover their costs? And we've certainly seen with the co-ops in some of the states are now in Kentucky, Ohio, are actually going up and can't, cover the claims. The claims, under the medical loss ratio, 80-20 or 85-15, depending on whether you're a small or large business, insurance companies can only pay out, say, 20% in advance, but the 80% in claims. And so, but they're finding that, you know, that they're looking at 105% in terms of the claims. And so it's not a sustainable model. And I think it's unfortunate, I think, that a lot of the insurers, you know, thought that Obamacare would be a way for them to increase the number of enrollees. But if the enrollees are costing them more than they're being able to bring in, it, you know, they can't stay in business. And I think, Mike, that's one of the reasons, following the U.S. Supreme Court decision in King v. Burwell, saying that the subsidies are legal for those people in the healthcare.gov and exchanges run by the federal government. I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing an expansion or a move towards merging of the big insurers. Anthem has purchased Humana.
Yes.
Anthem, former WellPoint, has just come to a deal to purchase Cigna, and Centene purchased U.S. Health in Los Angeles. So, you know, the insurers are saying, well, you know, if we amalgamate, if we merge and become larger, we'll be able to reduce costs and provide better service. But as we know in economics, when you concentrate an industry among a few providers, efficiencies, there won't be efficiencies. Costs will go up. And I think the worst thing is that the consumer will have less access to choice. And so these are, you know, between expanding Medicaid, which the president is pushing the states, exchanges. The other point is that, you know, those 34 states that didn't set up their own exchanges, as the president and people like, you know, around the country thought, well, all the states will want Jonathan Gruber, you know, will go and want to set up their own exchanges. Well, when they looked at the cost, they said, hey, we're not going to do that. So 34 states are now covered under healthcare.gov. With the King v. Burwell ruling, you're seeing a number of states that had set up, of those 14 states in D.C. that had set up their own exchanges, they're financially, you know, insolvent, or they can't seem to make it work. It's too expensive. And so they're moving now over to healthcare.gov. So it wouldn't be surprising if in the next year or two, if Obamacare is not repealed and replaced, that, you know, all of the, there won't be any more state exchanges. Healthcare.gov, the feds will be running the whole exchange program, which is very disappointing. So we've seen the president trying to expand, get this, all states to be in Medicaid. Other states that set up their own exchanges, finding that it would be better for them to go with the federal exchange, healthcare.gov. And now you're seeing the big insurers, you know, trying to merge. We'll see whether the Federal Trade Commission or the U.S. Department of Justice allows these mergers, but we're seeing additional concentration. These are all bad signs for patients, i.e. consumers. And one of the reasons why it's so important that we repeal and replace Obamacare. And the Republicans, you know, need to get their act together. There are a number of plans out there that look at, you know, replacement plans, but they need to get one plan and rally around it so that the American people in this 2016 election, which, you know, will be here before we know it, will know what is it. The Republicans talk about repeal, but what is their replacement agenda, so that we can see how we will be better off and have better health coverage and better health care, assuming the Republicans, of course, is a big assumption, yes, win the presidency and keep control of Congress in 2016. Then, in 2017, I think one of the main agenda items in that new Congress in January 2017 and the president would be to introduce a bill to repeal Obamacare and replace it with a program that puts doctors and patients in charge of health care and not the federal government, as we have seen increasingly under Obamacare.
Well, you know, it's funny, Sally, every time you bring up a scholarly issue, you know, this time talking about the mergers, I can bring up examples, you know, down in the trenches where that's exactly what's happening down to the letter. Because in my world, what we're seeing in local markets is mergers of hospitals into bigger systems, hospital acquisition of physician practices, hospital acquisitions of other things like radiology practices. And I was just talking to my staff yesterday, I mean, less than 24 hours ago, that a particular radiology group that we used to use that gave great customer services at good prices was purchased, and all of a sudden, all of those great things about their operations are all out the window. The prices have gone through the roof. You know, the service has changed, and, you know, the landscape's changing underneath us. And just like you said, Sally, every time something like this happens, it's the patients that suffer. Because the prices go up, you know, you get, just like you said, supply and demand. You start having fewer suppliers, prices go up, shortages happen. You know, I suspect that there won't be much opposition at the federal level for all of these mergers because, as we discussed in the earlier segments, you know, these are all, you know, pre-planned under-the-table steps to get towards single-payer. And certainly if you have fewer insurers, fewer doctor groups, and fewer hospitals, I think that's exactly where they want us to go.
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, it was very interesting to me when Karen Ignani stepped down as the head of AHIP, the American Health Insurance Plan, their lobbying group. And who is it that is the new head of AHIP? None other than Marilyn Tavener, the former head of CMS.
Surprise,
Centers
surprise.
For Medicare and Medicaid,
yes.
Services. And so, I mean, it's, to me, it's like putting the fox in charge of the chicken coop. I mean, she was one of the key designers of Obamacare, and now she's going to be advising her members of the health insurers. So I think this is a very auspicious move,
yes,
by AHIP, but it just shows, and you're right, I mean, the amalgamations, I mean, 49% of new graduating specialists are now joining hospital groups. They because of the mandates on doctors and the, all the coding, all of the regulation, you know, it's easier for them to join a hospital group and they get a regular, get a salary that you know what it is, and have a more regular 9-to-5 job. And so it's really turning healthcare into sort of a regulated utility industry. And I think it's very sad, but the individual doctor or the docs who are in the small group market are just being pushed out because they can't afford to comply with the essential benefit plans, the electronic health records, all of the things.
Absolutely.
That are causing doctors to not want to be individual businesses.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing, again, I keep singing the same tune every time you make another point, Sally, because in my world, everything you're saying is right there, and I'll see it when I've got my first patient visit in less than an hour, is that, you know, all of these burdens, whether it's HIPAA or meaningful use, all of the, you know, hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations that govern our behavior, make it more and more difficult to maintain your own practice. And yes, more and more docs are saying, look, I got to outsource all this and just go and work for a big, you know, work for a big hospital. And, you know, going with that is this whole ratio, and I suspect you've seen these numbers before, Sally, of you know, the ratio in terms of new hirees into the healthcare field. That 95% of the folks who are getting hired into healthcare are not people who touch patients. Yeah, administrators,
right.
You know, bureaucrats, et cetera.
No, and another very frightening thing is that, you know, the president thought with Obamacare, you know, there are too many specialists. Doctors are lining their pockets by, you know, getting patients to have all of these, you know, extensive tests and treatments. But, of course, doctors, you know, order tests because of medical malpractice laws. They're afraid of being sued. They're not doing it to line their pockets. But doctors are seeing their salaries, you know, go down under Obamacare. But even more frightening is who will be the students that decide, unless we repeal and replace Obamacare, to go into medicine. I just think that we'll see in a few years the best and the brightest are not going to go into a field where they can't be entrepreneurial. And the American Association of Medical Colleges has predicted by 2020, there will be a shortage of around 90,000 doctors. Half would be primary care doctors, and half would be general surgeons. This is exactly the opposite conclusion of what the president said, promised the American people with his Affordable Care Act. He said, you know, we're spending too much money on specialists. We need to have more primary care docs. Well, fewer people are going into primary care, and because of, you know, all of the rules, regulations, the limits on your income. And so we'll see fewer people in primary care, And that is exactly the opposite of what President Obama promised us. And what does it mean for the American people? You can have a care card and you can have coverage, but if you can't find a doctor, as we said earlier, it doesn't do anything for you as a patient.
It's nothing but a piece of cardboard. Well, believe it or not, we are at the end of the third segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio with special guest Sally Pipes. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back once again. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. We have with us very special guest Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute. We are discussing the issues surrounding the 50th anniversary of Medicare, Medicaid, the largest program in history designed to provide health care for a society, and it's a daunting challenge, right? I mean, the world's been trying for over 100 years to figure out this daunting challenge of how you take care of sick folks, and you know, this will hit home with, you know, every single person with a heartbeat. You know, it's come to my world personally very recently because of two mountain bike accidents, one that I had a couple of weeks ago and one that a friend of mine had just yesterday who is still in the hospital, and so my thoughts are with him this morning. But, you know, the first thing you think about is, you know, how badly am I hurt or how sick am I, and, you know, when am I going to be able to get better? And most importantly for, you know, folks like us is, you know, when are we going to be able to get back to work and be productive? So, you know, it's a very daunting problem how to figure it out. The problem is the solutions that appear to be very easy and right in front of you may work in the short term, but they end up causing bigger problems in the long term. And, you know, after 120 years of various attempts at socialized medicine at one form or another, and most recently 50 years of Medicare and Medicaid, I think, Sally, we're kind of up against it.
Well, we are. And as I said in the beginning, you know, these programs, Medicare and Medicaid, are out of control. There's a lot of fraud. The costs are out of control. They are not going to be sustainable, as we now have 71 million Americans. That's 1 in 5 Americans is enrolled in Medicaid, the program for low-income Americans. And the baby boomers, you know, we have around about 50 million people in Medicare, but, you know, 10,000 baby boomers are joining the ranks of age 65 and over every day. And so these programs are not sustainable. And then we have, you know, a healthcare law, which turned 5 on March 23rd this year, the healthcare law, the Obamacare, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, that it's not protecting patients and it's not affordable, as we've talked about earlier. And really, you know, my worry is, you know, are we on the path, as you said too much, to a single-payer healthcare program or Medicare for all? The program that the late Senator Ted Kennedy, really, that was his goal. He, of course, would not have, you know, have been subject to a waiting list or ration care because of his income status. But really, I'm Canadian. I grew up under Medicare for All. I know what the problems are. Costs are out of control. Government has to set global budgets. So, you know, in Canada today, the average Canadian waits over 18 weeks. That's over 4 months from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist. care is rationed, and lack of access to the latest treatment and technologies, because the hospitals, which are run by the government, have so many pressures on their budgets, they can't afford the latest positron emission tomography machine, the latest MRI machine. So all of this is rationed. This is what, you know, the debate is moving around. The president wants single-payer. Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, who is challenging Hillary Clinton, he is pushing that single-payer bell again. And the last thing that we want in America, people come to America from all over the world for the greatest healthcare, the greatest innovations in research and development in pharmaceuticals, biologics. They all take place in America, not in countries where the government is in control of the healthcare system. And if you go to Great Britain, and every morning, you know, the Brits love their newspapers, and there must be, you know, if you're in a hotel, there will be 10 different newspapers, the Telegram, the Times, the Telegraph, the Times, the Independent, the Daily Mail, the Evening Standard, all of these papers, left-wing, middle-of-the-road, right-wing papers, the front page every day is talking about a scandal with the National Health Service costing out of control, patients dying, waiting, patients not being able to get dentists. All of these catastrophes, we don't want America to lose its position providing the very best health care in the world, and why people come here, because we do have the greatest research hospitals, the greatest treatments and procedures. And, you know, if we don't repeal and replace Obamacare, I can see us going down the path to mediocrity, and really the federal government will be running the whole health care system, and it's a very daunting past and very daunting future. I mean, I know today is a big day for the Republicans. The first presidential debates take place today in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland. There will be two debates. I sort of compare this to the slams in tennis. You know, in whether you're talking about the U.S. Open or Wimbledon, a number of people who, you know, aren't that high in the rankings have to qualify to get into the main draw. I see the same thing with these debates today. We've got 10 people who are going to be in the primetime debate or in the main draw, and then we have another 6 people who, you know, are in the second tier or in the qualifying round. So it's going to be interesting to see whether what the question is on health care, on each of these candidates' positions on repeal and replace of Obamacare, or what their plans are. And of course, the big wild card, as you know, Mike, is in the primetime debate is Donald Trump, who seems to be polling very well. What is he going to say when asked about health care? Is he just going to say, I have a terrific solution, you know, America is a terrific country, or is he going to really talk about what he would do? And he was early on a supporter of Obamacare. So it's an interesting afternoon and evening with the first of the debates coming out on as a joint debate between Fox News and Facebook.
So on the subject of the debates, how do you think Donald Trump's going to handle it? Do you think he's going to come out swinging, or do you think he's going to play it close to the vest? I mean, if you're the Donald, what's the wise thing to do?
Well, I think he's really, you know, got a lot of people excited about the Donald, and, you know, he's a great chatterer and a great talker. He actually has not registered as a candidate in any state as yet. I think he likes to play it close to the chest with his money. That's probably why he has so much money.
Yes.
But what is he going to do? I think he'll use a lot of pejoratives, a lot of talk. We have to, you know, all Americans have to have access to affordable, accessible, quality health care. But what will his plan be? Does he have a policy menu of what he would do? I don't know, but I would say probably not. But as I just said, I think he did support Obamacare. He supports the idea of universal coverage. How would that be attained? Is he going to talk about repealing and replacing Obamacare, but expanding Medicare, so we'll have, you know, a giant government program and a private program? I just don't know, but I think it's going to be interesting. Does he actually have a plan? And will he be willing to talk about it, or is he just going to be, you know, giving a lot of rhetoric? I think the interesting thing to me is we have all of these candidates in the race. I think it's too many. I mean, it's ridiculous. that some people are, you know, put their name in the ring, and how will they raise the funding? Just an expensive proposition to run for president. But, you know, it's interesting, the excitement about Donald Trump, and it shows that the American people are fed up, I think, with politics and with Washington, and they see Donald Trump as sort of a fresh, you know, fresh off the farm voice to talk about, you know, let's not stick with the tried and true. We need competition. We need to reduce regulations, mandates. We need the entrepreneurial spirit to reign once again so that America can be, you know, a strong country that everybody looks up to. And right now, this country is going down the path to an entitlement society and really losing its edge. You know, just because a nation is great once doesn't mean it has that position forever. And we really need to get this country back on track and reduce the role of federal, state, and local governments in people's lives.
Well, yeah, history is replete with examples of exactly what you're talking about. And, I think we totally agree on all that stuff. To me, Donald Trump is, if nothing else, he's honest. You know, he doesn't have a filter. And, at least you can have some faith, whether you like what he's saying or not, that what comes out of his mouth has not been pasteurized, homogenized, sterilized, you know, run through advisors and market researchers and that kind of stuff. And I think, just like you said, I think that's what people are craving, is just a bit of honesty and a bit of candor. You know, even if you do, you know, stick your foot in it once in a while, at least it's honest and it's real.
But, I mean, I think we all thought, you know, President Obama was elected, you know, in a landslide in 2008, with Obamacare coming in 2010, with things going on, with things with increasing incursions into the energy sector. Most people thought, well, he was a one-term president. People thought that, you know, the Republicans would be able to win that presidential race in 2012 easily. But unfortunately, the candidate, Mitt Romney, didn't provide the kind of answers that the American people were looking for. And because he had been, you know, the architect of RomneyCare in Massachusetts, which, of course, had a lot of problems, for some reason, he didn't have the guts or the chutzpah to stand up and say, you know, I thought this was going to be a great program for Massachusetts that was going to lead to affordable, accessible, quality care for all people. Unfortunately, it didn't, and therefore we don't want this model for the rest of the country. And it's probably because a lot of his, he had so many advisors saying, oh, you don't want to upset this apple cart, you don't want to do that. And consequently, you know, he never really stood for anything and never really pushed Obama on the problems with Obamacare, and the president was reelected. And now, you know, with the second term, with the second Supreme Court loss for us, the first one on the issue of whether the individual mandate was sustainable, and now on the King v. Burwell on the subsidies, you know, I'm very, very worried, because the more people get entrenched in the government program, Mike, and even if it's not working for them, look at Canada, even with a conservative prime minister. I mean, it's impossible to take something away from people.
You can't take it back.
Even if
you
it's
know.
Not working.
Right. It's because, again, it's just the in-your-face kind of pullback is just very hard for people to accept. Sally, we are out of time. It's the top of the hour. Thank you very much for being with us today. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Come back next week.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.